All right. So, peace, brothers and sisters. Hold on for a second. Let me
do peace.
All right. So, peace, brothers and sisters. I want to welcome you guys to this week's Black Wallace Matter Town Hall meeting. My name is Brother Lou, obviously. And, you know, I just want to welcome you to come hang out with us. Since we don't have a lot of people on the call today, I'm not even going to go through the whole introduction that I normally do because everyone already knows. So I'm going to just open up the floor really quick to talk about ways to close the black wealth gap. I have been thinking about like I was just explaining to the sister, I was studying how the Chinese was able to figure out a way around, you know, this U.S. monopoly where they just go around from, you know, country to country. They install their military bases. They install their federal Federal Reserve system, their central banking system, and they basically dominate. But what the Chinese have been able to do is figure out a way to thwart some of their advances by using a lot of their by using their greed. So, for instance, one of the things that the Chinese did, I guess this was back in the 70s or whatever it started. China has a very large market. They have, 1.5 billion people, right? So they have like about five times as many people as we do. So what the Chinese people realized is that if they wanted to become a world power, that they would have to elevate the look, or they would have to elevate the status and the worldview of their people. So if you go back and you look at like cartoons and movies and things like that of how they showed the Chinese, how they showed the Chinaman back in the day, he had the buck teeth, he had that round little hat that looked like an umbrella, and he had the little pigtail in the back and ching chong, right, all of that. And usually he was like lazy. They would show him he would be lazy. He would be smoking opium. He would have that pipe. He would be smoking dope and stuff like that. That really was a depiction of like all the people they had that were out in like the rice paddies and, you know, all of that stuff like that. So what they did was they set up a plan to make their people become more industrious. And how they went about doing that was they opened up, they said that we are going to open up our market for trade, but we need help. This is what they said to America. And America was like, all right, cool. So guy Henry Kissinger came over there and they signed this deal. I forgot the name of the deal. But with China, the stipulation, the masterstroke that they said, listen, if you want our people to become more productive and, you know, and able to help you guys with the manufacturing, like we'll do the manufacturing for you cheaper than you can do it in America. But what you have to do is you have to partner with a Chinese company and you have to train the Chinese people with all the technology and all the skills that you have, right? And they said, what we will do is we will lower the cost for you to produce goods. So if you remember back in the 60s and the 70s and things like that, that's when we started having rising inflation. You know, we had a lot of things that were made in the USA, and the next thing you know, stuff started coming in from Japan. And then sort of like towards the mid-80s, late 80s to the 90s, everything started being made in China. And that's because, you know, but during that period from the 70s and the 80s, a lot of large American companies, they were going out to China and they were teaching these people. And the Chinese government was taking all those people from out in the countryside, out in the rice paddy, sending them into these towns, sending them into these cities. China was building up crazy, crazy cities, building up crazy, crazy factories. And now they have these Americans coming in, teaching them the game, giving them the technology, teaching them how the manufacturing process and all of this stuff, and now they're able to manufacture the same thing that would probably take $20 in America. They're able to manufacture it for $2 in China. Then they send it over here to us, and now the prices are lower, and now you get companies like Walmart and Target and all these other kind of companies who basically, in dollar stores and all of that stuff, they basically dominate. But what happened was when the American companies started exporting the manufacturing out to China, they basically gutted the middle class. They basically gutted all of those, you know, all of these white people that were working in these factories, all of those towns and all of that stuff. That's why you got like the Rust Belt, and you know, you got all these old towns like in Kentucky and West Virginia and all of these, you know, all of that, Detroit, right? All of those manufacturing towns, they died. And these American companies, they did not care. They sold the people out. So that's the proof that I'm saying to you that, you know, they don't care about their own people like that. They will sell their own folks out if they can make a buck. And looking at the Chinese, looking at the way how they did this, right? So what the Chinese did, they go, they learn the technology, they learn the, you know, and then next thing you know, they'll knock off the same product. It'll look exactly the same because they have the same blueprint. The only thing that's missing is the same branding, but it's made the same exact way, and now they're able to sell a knockoff that looks the exact same for a cheaper price and whatever else. What I'm saying that we have to do is we have to start using those kinds of effective models. We have to be smart. And while I'm saying being smart, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. All we need to do is look at people who are currently successful. If people are currently successful against, you know, these colonizers, then that's all we need to do. We just need to copy the same formula, right? So one of the things that I was, you know, that we always talk about on these calls, we talk about buying our way into certain industries, right? And the reason why is because we're not learning the innovation, engineering, and all of that stuff. We're not learning that. It's that type of information is not being passed down to us, right? Because there's very slim chances that we have engineers in our families, we have chemical scientists in our families, and stuff like that. These are the people who are actually creating and innovating the technology that's moving the world forward or moving this country forward. But what we can do as 42 million black folks is we can pool our resources and we can go and buy a chemical manufacturing company. We can go and buy an engineering company or something like that. And then now we have acquired new technology that's not normally within our community. And we can just use it, right? If we go in and we have, and so what happens is we acquired a technology company, a chemical manufacturing company or whatever it is, and we make them train our people. We go and we bring back internships, and we go and be like, that's right, you teach this little black boy, this little black girl how to make paint, how to make latex paint, how to make turpentine, how to make, you know, industrial lubricants. You teach them this, and they have no other choice to do it because we're their bosses. Matter of fact, I was reading some of these guys that worked in the factories and stuff, like when their jobs were getting outsourced, they had to train their Chinese counterparts, or like in the IT industry, they had to train their Indian counterparts. They had to train them or they wouldn't get their severance package, right? So you got to train your replacement. That was just the craziest thing ever. But that's, you know, that's all in the name of making a buck. And that's essentially what these folks want to do. So that was one of the suggestions that I was saying in terms of how we can close the black wealth gap. So I have like a few other little different lessons, and this is just going to be an open call. So we can, anyone can chime in at any time, press star 6. So basically the first thing is learning the base. Well, so the first thing, like I just said, was like, you know, we need to acquire the information that we do not have. But the second thing is we have to learn the basics of financial literacy, right? So that's starting with a very simple principle like paying yourself first, knowing the difference between assets and liabilities, and making sure that the things that you invest in are actual assets that are going to appreciate. Does anyone want to weigh in on that? Does anyone disagree with that? Okay, cool. Brother Vaughn, here we go. Take it from the top, Brother Vaughn.
I agree with the whole, basically the whole, like, we got to do something in the nature of, and like you said, we ain't got to reinvent the wheel. Like we got to do something though that catches that attention, that gets the attention of those who are in power. But we got to be ready when we get their attention though, because they're not gonna like it. You know what I mean? I like as far as the industry of it though, and what I'm learning, just being like doing what I'm doing myself, what I'm learning or what my thought is, we need to find a way to figure out what we have, who we have, like what our people, what we do, like the individuals, like, because like you were saying, like it's not common to have an engineer or you know what I mean scientist like right in the household, but honestly, like we don't even know, like we probably, a lot of the stuff that we think we might have to outsource and all that stuff, and we might have it in house right now, but we need to like find a way to see, like, who do we have? What do we got? What do these people that we deal? Because I can see we deal with a lot of professionals. You know what I mean? And everybody in their professions and big into their professions and stuff like that. It's like, what do you do, though? Like, not to, you know, be in everybody's business, but it comes to a point to where it's like, if we got this stuff in-house and that.
What I meant by that is, I mean, like, you, like, it's prevalent. Like, you can, like, you know, you can throw a rock into a group of black folks and you're going to hit, like, a scientist or something like that. So that's what I'm saying. So you can be in Walmart, you know, you could just bump into any kind of white person. You have absolutely no idea what this person does. And the dude can be, like, a chemical engineer. I was in the park the other day. I was in the park by myself, but I take my kids there, and the guy was in there flying a drone, and man, you know, we just sitting there, we're talking, and then like five other guys pulled up, and they're flying like these model planes or whatever, and it's just a group of they're all pilots, and I'm sitting there like, yo, and it's like from the grandfather on down, and now the new son, the other guy, he just took his pilot's license. He's there, but now the even younger, like the teenager guy, he's there with all of them, and they're learning him, and they're teaching him about pitching yaw and roll and all of that stuff on a thing. This is, I was sitting there like, what? And they look like just a bunch of just regular white guys. You understand what I'm saying? And they have they literally have a pilot, a family of pilots. I mean, how that's not like common with our folks. You know what I'm saying? So that's what I'm saying. We need to start targeting certain industries, certain things, I have to emphasize, it has to be industries with a high barrier to entry, right? So becoming a pilot is a high barrier to entry. Becoming so now we do have a lot of lawyers. I'm noticing we do have a lot of lawyers and professionals, but like becoming a dentist or a neurosurgeon or like I said, a chemical scientist or, you know, computer engineer or something like that. The barriers to entry are very, very high. When the barrier to entry is high, that means that the pay is high. And when the pay is high, that, and you know, now you have a greater chance of having wealth and building wealth, right? And so that's what I'm saying. Like, we need to pick one of those types of industries or something like that to like build a beachhead for our folks.
Right.
All right.
Yep, I got you.
Okay, cool. So the next point, hold on, wait, we had a couple of people come in on the call. Hold on, brother. Caller from 405 area code. Your first name, please. Caller from 405 area code. Okay. Caller from 281 area code. Your first name, please.
Stacy.
Sister Tracy, hold on for a second, sister.
It's Stacy.
I'm sorry?
It's Stacy with an S.
Stacy, Sister Stacy. Okay, Sister Stacy. All right. Caller from 405 area code. Your first name, please. Hello, caller from 405-837. We're going to give caller, we'd like to know who we're on the line with. All right. If we can't get your first name, we're going to have to drop you from the call because we want to know who we're on the line with. Hello? Hello? Is your phone on mute? All right. So, okay, so the next point to close the Black wealth gap would be for us to adopt a legacy mindset. And so that's essentially mean leaving something for your children and their children. Hold on, so the caller came back. Caller from 405.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess I got muted. My name is Christian.
I'm sorry, brother.
My name is Christian.
You have a lot of noise in the background. I didn't catch that.
My name is Christian.
Okay, brother Christian. Okay, cool. Gotcha, brother. All right, thank you. Appreciate you back. All right. So like I said, so the next point, the next way to close the black gap, the black wealth gap would be to adopt a legacy mindset, which is leaving something for your children and their children. So if you want to start, you know, so some simple things that we can do right now, you could look towards getting insurance, life insurance. That would be a little leg up for your children or whatever. You could look into buying real estate. You can look into buying your own home. Owning rental property is not for everyone. I am telling you this as a landlord, a Section 8 landlord. It is rough. So I'm from New York. Buying real estate in New York was easy to do back in the days, but right now the prices are just like out of this world. So I do like investing outside of New York. I do investing in like New Jersey and Pennsylvania and stuff like that. When you find like the places that you're going to find that's going to be good deals, it's usually going to be like low income areas. Everybody is not cut out to be a landlord in a low income area. I am telling you this from personal experience. It is just madness, right? But you can't, if you have the nerves of steel, if you know amongst our people, you know, we have that idea, that concept of a slumlord and this and that. If you're in a low income area and you're dealing with like a bunch of Section 8 tenants and all that stuff, you're gonna have to be a little tough, right? Because you're not a person, you're not you're not like some big investment company. You're an individual who's putting your actual money on the line. So your tenants will be inside the property. They will let their kids put, flush toys down the toilet. They will flush, you know, sanitary napkins down the toilet. They will, you know, wash clothes for the whole neighborhood and all of this crazy stuff. All of that comes out of your pocket. So, you know, when I grew up living in the projects. I grew up living in apartments. I never even gave any of those types of expenses a second thought. Not that I tore up things, because my mother, you know, she liked to live nice. She didn't play that. But I never gave, like, the individual thing, you know, the toilet breaks, the sink breaks, hole gets in the wall or whatever it is. I never gave any of that stuff a second thought. As a landlord now, oh, my God, I am telling you, it is a nightmare. But if you make the investment wisely, buy cheap enough, if you go into like some of these lower income areas, you're able to buy properties cash maybe, which means you won't have any mortgage. That'd be really great for that. You can manage it and you may get a nice return on your investment. You can get 18-20% return on your investment for a year on the money that you invested. That's nice cash flow. If on my leases, so the rent is due on the first. After the fifth, then you incur a late fee after the fifth, and then you have until the 15th to, you know, pay the rent with the late fee, or otherwise we're going to court. It took me about 5 years to even get my lease that tight. I know some other people, they don't even play. The rent is due on the first, by the third it's late, and then by the fifth they're filing the eviction papers, stuff like that. I give my, you know, because I'm dealing with a bunch of brothers and sisters, I give them leeway. But what I was initially doing, I mean, I was giving, I got beat for rent for like 9 months one time. I mean, like, this guy was just giving me all kinds of sob stories. Oh, I just had a kid. Oh, I just had this. Oh, I just had that. I mean, I got beat for like 9 months worth of rent. You can't manage business that way. You can't manage money that way. You have to be, when it comes to building wealth, when it comes to managing your money, you have to take all of those dollar bills very, very, very seriously. Very, very seriously. I deal with a lot of these colonizers and you know, the different businesses that I'm in. Listen, it doesn't matter how much money they have. They do not play. They scrutinize every single little investment. Every single time it's like, all right, you got to put some more money in there. I mean, the men and the women, they sit down, pull out a calculator if need be, calculate and say, so it's going to cost this and it's going to return this. And let me see what are the expenses are going to be this. And like, they're serious about that. And that's what we need to be. I do a lot of business with brothers and sisters. We do a lot of back of the napkin calculations. We sit down, we look at stuff. We don't even really think about the math. We just like, I think it'll be a good idea. Or I feel good about this. No, we need to actually do the math. We need to actually do the math and sit down and see, is this a good investment? We need to see, is this investment going to give us a better return for some other, you know, a better return than some other kind of investment, right? So that's called opportunity cost, right? So you have, you know, $10,000. You can put, you know, you can put it into this investment now and get, you know, 10%, or you can hold it for 6 months, and then there's another investment that's going to come, and you may be able to get 15 or 20%, right? That's how we really need to be serious about managing our money if we ever really want to accumulate wealth, if we ever want to close this wealth gap. By some estimates, well, calculations, they said the average white folks is like, the average white person is like 250 years ahead of us in wealth. So they have like, you know, like about like their wealth, the average person, their wealth is like about 100 grand and ours is like 1500 or something stupid like that, right? They're saying like the vast majority of us, in a pinch or emergency, we can't get our hands on like $1,500 in cash. So, you know, I'm just telling you, little things that we have to really get serious about that. We get the money. We get 1.3 to 1.4 money. We get the money. The biggest thing that we do is we finance everything. I notice, I sell a lot of things to folks, and usually I'm able to sell the vast majority of things if I set up something like a payment plan. And then that's when you get people chasing Peter, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. We finance a lot of stuff, financing furniture, financing TVs, financing cars, doing all this stuff. We need to go back to like how it was before they allowed us to fully participate in this economy. We had to save our money and then buy things cash. When you buy things cash, then you don't have that bill hanging over your head, and you haven't spent your future dollars. And that's again like what I was talking about, the opportunity cost, right? So I don't know much about life insurance. We had a sister on a few weeks back. She was talking about life insurance thing, but if that probably could be a start. Again, like I said, you can go and you can start looking at real estate. Me personally, I'm advocating starting businesses, specifically lifestyle businesses that make passive recurring income. I am telling you, that is the absolute best thing ever. So I learned about the concept of passive income, I don't know, maybe in like 1990, maybe something like that. And I was like, wow, this sounds really good. And I tried all different types of businesses and all different types of things to do. So initially what I had to do is I had to be active with my income. So that means I had to get out there and I had to sell. So I never really worked at any place. I never really had a job. I've always, you know, been my own self-made person. I got out there and I went and I sold and I cut hair door to door. Then when I made enough money from that, I saved my money. I used to sell, you know, some people you hear me talk about, I used to sell balloons, I used to sell water guns, I used to sell lights at the at like carnivals and stuff like that. I saved my money, and then I opened up a barbershop. Then I had the barbershop, and I built it up. And then one day, it dawned on me. So I had learned the idea of, I had learned the concept of passive income, but, you know, I was like, well, I don't have any money to invest right now, so I have to go out there and get the money. When I opened up my barbershop, it was like one of these days it dawned on me. It was like, yo, man, if I don't get up and go and open these gates and go cut hair, I don't eat. I was like, this sucks. This is a job. Like, this is not a business. This is a freaking job. And so then I had to go back and start looking at my, you know, my notes and my studies and things like that. For anyone who is not clear, a business is a system that transfers value to your customers in exchange for money. And it does it without needing you in between, right? You have to build the system. If you have to be there to actually facilitate the business, facilitate the transaction, what you have, you own a job. You don't own a business, you own a job, right? In some service businesses, if you get paid a lot of money, like a dentist or a lawyer or something like that, then that's all fine and good. But like me, I was a barber standing on my feet cutting hair all day, excuse me. And if I didn't open up those gates, then I couldn't, you know, I wouldn't eat. So what I did was I shifted gear and I started hustling hard to go find barbers. I started to go find people to replace me. And that's not easy. Finding employees to replace you, that's not easy. But I will tell you, you're going to hustle hard up front. You're going to put in the work up front, but then it will pay dividends in the end. So I haven't cut hair. Well, I mean, I still cut my son's hair, and every now and then I go to the shop. I may throw on, you know, I still have my station and stuff, but I haven't actively worked in the shop since I opened the shop in 97, probably since 2003 or 4. So technically, I've kind of been, like, retired for a while. Then from there, I got into, like, real estate. And so the only things that I look at now, the only businesses, most of the only businesses I consider are passive recurring income businesses. I'm telling you, it's the best, because if you're sick, you still can pay your bills. If you just don't feel like getting up and going to do something, you still can pay your bills. If you want to go on vacation like I do in the summer and just get up, I go down south and go see my pops for like a month or two. I go down there, and I don't even know when I'm coming back. I just go down there and be like, all right, what's up? And if I feel good, if it's not too hot, I stay. It doesn't matter. Bills still get paid. I'm telling you, it's the greatest feeling in the world. It's the greatest way to set up your business. Now, I understand if you didn't plan your business out like that from the beginning, you got to start now. It would be great to be able to pass something like that on to your children. That kind of dovetails into what we're trying to, with our fundraiser, our business in a box fundraiser, that the cell phone kiosk. It's basically a passive income business. You get the kiosk, you put the kiosk in a barbershop or a beauty salon, and that's how I know it's a good thing, because I have one in my shop. But you put the thing in the barbershop in a beauty salon, or a beauty salon, or a convenience store, or a waiting room someplace at a hospital gift shop or wherever. And the thing, they basically sell itself, the cell phone accessories. Everybody is always looking for a way to charge their phone, another cord, a charger for the car, or whatever it is. You know, the headphones, they need headphones or whatever it is. So that's essentially what that business, in a box is about. And after we have the raffle, which will be next week, after we have the raffle, then I'll do a write up or maybe a video walk through the whole thing, break it down, because we actually had some people who purchased them outright. And Sister Marie, she actually called me earlier, and she was talking about how she wanted to implement this for her grandchildren. So I'm going to open up her phone right now and let her explain what her thoughts were. Sister?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Peace. Okay, so could you just share a little bit, like, what your goals, what your intentions are, and, you know, share the sentiment that you had with me a little bit earlier?
Sure. I have a 16-year-old granddaughter that's going to be 17 in maybe about 2 months. And I was thinking about, when me and you were talking about it, I wanted to get like 5 kiosks and actually put it in a route for her. And that actually teaches her how to first do accounting, keep records of all her inventory and how much money she's supposed to make, and also gives her the opportunity to learn that she has to get up, go stock her inventory, and give her a chance to go talk to some of the businesses to get her kiosks put in there. So while she's young, it'll kind of help her as she goes along in life to learn about, you know, like money. It also, me and you talked about, it keeps a lot of youth, because a lot of youth right now don't have money. Most of our kids are basically taught to go to school and get a high-paying job, go work for someone. Now, I've always said this, and I told my mom this, I said any time a country has to do a law to basically make someone hire a certain amount of people when there's so many of us, 45 million of us, you know, it just doesn't sound right to me, and therefore that tells me that our kids are going to suffer. So what I thought about when you told me about that, I said that would be good to go out and talk to some of these, you know, young guys about, you know, that's basically running around here trying to get money by stealing, robbing, or selling drugs or whatever. That'll help them I think what you're talking about can go a long way. I think it's awesome, and I think it gives our youth a chance to understand I can make money and do it legal instead of doing it illegally and ended up in jail. You know, just like the case where the teenagers were stealing I think it was a Ding Dong or something, and they had like 12 or 13 cops run down on the kids. I mean, a lot of this can help these kids, and parents can help them, and this can stop a lot of this by helping them, you know, basically run their own business, because that's basically what they'll be doing. Like you just say, even if they go out of town, well, they know what they know what products they got in the store. They know how much money they're supposed to make. It gives them the chance to talk to other business people and work out a deal to either pay $1 or $2. Hey, if you sell my products in your store, I'm willing to give you $1.50 for every product you sell, or $2 or whatever it may be. And that gives them a chance to still learn math, to understand get the understanding of how money works and how it can be multiplied and how they can end up saving and plus still stay off the street corner or out of someone's house from breaking in. So I actually talked to my son today after I got off the phone with you, and me and him talked, and with her being in high school, me and him both said that's a wonderful idea, which you already know I'm going in surgery. So as soon as I get done with my surgery, me and him is working on the money now. We are going to get her 5, and we're going to get a route that's like within no more than 20 to 30 minutes away from the home, but different spots where she, you know, can go. And either I will go with her since I'm retired, or either some of the days he's off, he can go with her. Just to get her to understand, so that way she can start saving up for a car, she can start saving up for her college or whatever she wants to do, and different things like that. So, yes, it's a wonderful idea. And, I think it's very amazing. And just to let you know, I am an insurance agent, because I heard you talking about insurance, so I do sell insurance too.
Okay, cool. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about, like, life insurance, or like, you know, some easier ways to get into that. Because we had the sister on, she was saying, there was another sister on the week prior, and she was talking about how we could use that to actively build wealth, or build an income, or build like a nest egg while we're still alive. That was the impression that I was under. But then when the sister, she explained it to me, it didn't seem like that's what it was. So
basically, I'll be honest with you, because you won't get insurance people to be, some people will just not be honest with you. I'm not in it to make money, although I do make money. I will tell you the truth, okay? I love term insurance. Reason being, you get it from one point to a certain point, and your premium stays that amount. Let's say if I gave you $150,000 worth of insurance, well, I gave you a 25-year plan. So 25 years, your plan stays the same. Now, when that 25 years up and you don't pass, all that money is gone out the way, because I guarantee you, by that time, your insurance is going to go up. Now, the sad part to that is the price of the insurance going up. Now, for its whole life insurance, I can give you a plan, maybe $75,000, $100,000. It might cost you $115,000 or $120,000, maybe a little bit more, but that price stays for the same throughout the whole time of your life. Now, the difference with that is that part of that money goes to your insurance payment. It's almost like financing. They don't tell you that, but basically what it is, because so much goes to your premium for your life insurance, but then so much goes into a savings. Okay, now, the point of the savings is, at least that's what they tell you, it's supposed to be, well, if you run into a bind, you can borrow your money. But the point, the thing of it is, the insurance company is going to tell you you can borrow your own money, but they're going to charge you interest on your own money. And I just can't deal with that fact, so I don't lie to people. I tell them the truth. Because one thing about it, only way you're going to get both the insurance, your premium, your face value, and your savings that you put in there, if you live and die at the same time, and we both know that's not going to happen. So that means your family... Your family is only going to get the policy amount. That savings, if you never touched it, it goes to the insurance company. Your family doesn't get it. So all of that money you actually put in there, you saving, and you never touched it, and you thinking, okay, well, my policy is $100,000, and I got like $40,000 in my savings. Well, your family is only going to get that $100,000. That $40,000 go to the insurance company. And I think that is totally unfair. So I don't like to stay home. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. So when the sister was saying the thing to me, I didn't want to like jump in. When she was explaining, when she was giving us the explanation. But there is something called, I think it's called universal whole life or something like that, it's called an infinite banking strategy. And so essentially what from my understanding of the strategy is, so you would buy the whole life insurance policy, and then when you need to borrow that money, so the interest rate that you would get would be lower than what you would probably get from a bank or something like that. And then what you would do is you would take that money and you would use that to go buy an asset. So for instance, I didn't really want to get into it too much when the sister was having an explanation. But from what I understand is you would go and you would buy your policy. When you get a certain, I forgot what they call that money that you can pull out. When you get a certain amount of that money, you could go and let's say it's like $100,000. You can pull out the $100,000. You may have a 3% interest rate. That's a great interest rate. If you go and you buy a property or you go and you buy an investment that's going to give you 10%, 15% return on investment, 20% return on investment, your repayment is only 3%. You got the 17% spread. And essentially, that's what the people who are using this in this like high net worth and more sophisticated people, they're doing this. But that's how they're setting it up. They're putting this money in. They're getting the protection from the insurance. They're pulling it out, and they're putting it into investments that's giving them a higher yield than the interest rate that they have to pay back.
And that is true. You can do that, but the only way you can do that is when that means that the money that's inside of there, you have to wait so long for that money to progress to that $100,000. Now, once you take that $100,000 off of there, and your insurance is gone then, right? But with you having $100,000, you wouldn't need insurance no more neither. So it's a You see what I'm saying?
Why would you need the insurance?
Well, because I mean the normal rate to bury someone is less anywhere from 5 to maybe 10,000, right? Well, you didn't save in your policy $100,000. Once you take that $100,000 out for a loan to go do what you're saying you're gonna do, well, if you don't pay that back, your policy is canceled. But at the same time, you don't need that $100,000 policy you had before, because actually now you got $100,000 cash that you can go take and flip and start investments, and that's where your nest egg come from. So I can understand that point. That's basically selling your insurance, because even if you was to take all of your cash value out, your policy is gone. Your policy is gone, because basically your policy is there only to cover you in death. But if you take out the savings, that's all it wrote. And if you don't pay that savings back, okay, that's all you get, because basically you can't live and die at the same time to get the face value, and you can't get the savings portion. So if you take out the savings portion and you don't pay it back, your face value is gone. But at the same
But that's what I'm saying. So the strategy, as I understood it, you continue to pay your premiums, but you pay it with you make sure that you're generating more income. Then you make sure that you're generating more income than what your payments are. But I mean, I'm not an insurance professional, so
I get what you're saying, but at the same time, that's what I'm trying to get you to understand. Okay, let's say you take out a $100,000 policy, right? You got a cash value in there. Okay, you pay for this policy for 50 years. Okay, inside that policy, you're never going to get to the $100,000. Let's just be clear about that. They're not going to let you get to that point. You might get up to maybe, I'll just give or take, $30,000, $40,000. Okay, now let's say you want to go take that $40,000 out and you want to borrow against it. They will let you borrow against that and keep your premium, I mean your face value. But if you take all of it out, that's not borrowing. You're taking all your money out. So, like I say, it goes back to where you can't live and die at the same time, because you're not going to get both. Now, if you maybe take $25,000 out, and let's say you take $25,000 out and you still paying your premium, but at the same time you're going to get a loan or go do investments, you still got to bring them back what you took plus your interest to keep that policy going. If you don't do that, that policy gone. I don't care how much you think you're paying your premium. If you do not pay that, it's gone. And then what they're going to do is, like, when you die, you thinking your family going to get that $100,000, and let's say you owe them $20,000 on a loan. Well, your family is going to get $80,000, because they're going to take that out of your premium. They're going to take that out of your face value. That's why it's good to really look at insurance and make sure you're getting the right policy for yourself and your family. Now, there are policies, like, where you can do, people sell policies all the time. Let's say if you're an investor and someone is sickly with cancer and their baby probably at their final stage, okay, now, well, maybe got 6 months to live, and let's say a family is broke, they don't have any money. Well, you can sometimes people sell their policies because, and they might say, well, I want to sell my $100,000 policy. They might come to you and say, would you buy this for $50,000? Well, I would buy it for $50,000, because you know what? That person sells it over to me. It's mine, but I keep paying them premium for the next 6 months. Might cost me, what, $400, $500, $600, maybe let's say $1,500 at the most. The person only got 6 months. Well, I'm going to look at it, and that's a good investment, because once I pay that, keep paying it for the 6 months, and that person passed, guess what I get? I get that $100,000 policy. Okay. You see what I'm saying? So there's different policies out there, and there's different ways that you can do it, plus there's different mutual funds and different things out there. So the best thing that I tell people is to look at their family situation. I don't like, we're not really supposed to say it, but I don't like whole life because of that particular clause. of the savings, because even though I might not borrow that money because I'm investing in myself and investing in to leave something for my kids, but if I'm only going to leave them $100,000 when I should have been leaving them $140,000, why would I give an insurance company my savings that should be going to my kids? That's not good. That's not good. I don't care how anybody says it. It's not good. Now, but in certain situations, and I'm going to be honest with you, I had insurance at the particular time, but I ended up sick. Well, my mom ended up sick with cancer, first of all, so I moved her from one place to my place. So I had a house note. I had three children. Then I had to take care of her. She was getting real sick. Then I canceled out all her bills and finalized everything and paid them off. And once I moved her in, things started getting rougher and rougher and rougher because I had to pay this, that, and the other, and a lot of my money started going out the window. So I kind of like neglected my insurance, so I still never thought about it. Now that's 2 years later, and I never thought about it. And guess what? I got
Hello, guys. Hello, can you guys hear me? Hello, can anyone hear me? Press star six. Hello?
I can hear you.
Oh, I don't know. I think my internet cut out or something like that. My internet just went off and restarted, and we lost the whole call.
Oh,
all right.
Man.
Oh, shoot. Sorry. Yeah, hello? Hello? Hold on, wait a minute. Hello?
It's okay, I wasn't saying anything.
No, it just cut off. Guys, what you were saying?
I wasn't saying anything.
Oh, okay. All right, so we have a few people in the queue. All right, hold on. Sir. Brother Leon.
Hey there, Brother Leon. Yeah, I just in the queue. When you fell off, I was trying to let you know that I could hear you. But we'll get back to the question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Hello, sister.
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry, I didn't know what happened. Can you guys hear me?
My phone had went out. My internet is acting crazy. But I was just summarizing for you. So I basically was telling them, you know, I was summarizing you know the importance of the investment in insurance and looking at it. But, you know, I wanted to cover a few more points. This, so it's like I said, there's not a lot of people on the call tonight, so we can wrap it up kind of early. So I thank you for the information. And, you know, definitely, you know, I want to talk to you behind the scenes a little bit more. Because maybe there's
okay,
something
I
that
definitely,
we can get together.
I definitely want to get that kiosk. I'm definitely going to invest in that. That's, I mean, I think it's awesome, and I think it's a great idea, and I love it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sister. So essentially, before I got cut off, I was saying that, you know, it's the characters, some character traits, and building value with my children. And, you know, I don't know if any of this resonates with you, but I definitely teach my children how money works. So, you know, so I teach them a money management formula. As soon as they get money, I teach them to take 20% of that money and put it away no matter what. Use that money to invest in a business or whatever it is. So, like, you know, these kiosks, my kids have kiosks and stuff like that. Take 30% of the money and use that towards building for the business, right? So you take a certain other portion of your money and you go, I mean, well, once you have your business going, you take 30% of that money and you start looking for making other kind of passive investments. And then once you get your let's say some rental property or whatever it is, you would take 40% of those profits. See, so that's money that's just compounding on top of money. And now you have a nest egg to work with. That's how I teach my kids how to manage money. I teach my kids to be in control of their own destiny. So I teach them that, hey, listen, you can be whatever it is that you want to be. You can do whatever it is you want to do. I don't teach my kids about racism blocking them. So I let them know that, you know, that racism does exist. It's something that they should be mindful of. But I tell them never to use that as an excuse. I never tell them to say, oh, they can't, they won't let us. I don't use words like that with my kids. I teach my kids the importance of creating value and bringing something to the market. This American economy is based on selling. It's based on consumption. It's based on capitalism. It's based on entrepreneurship. And we don't prioritize that amongst our folks. And we need to. We have to get very serious. That needs, I mean, you know, we're spiritual people, we're emotional people, but it's like we do that and don't really focus on the business aspect. And there needs to be some kind of balance. So, you know, I stress my kids the importance of starting a business. I stress to them the importance of understanding commerce and creating value. I also teach my kids the values of persistence and consistency. So I tell them, listen, okay, you start something, right? You got to keep doing it, keep doing it. You may fail the first time. You may fail the first 10 times. But if the end goal is worth it to you, then you have to go ahead and persist. And then once you're able to achieve a goal or achieve an outcome, then you have to be consistent in working that because you want to maintain that level of excellence. I explained to them that everyone cannot be excellent. It's a rare thing for excellence. That's why we love celebrities and superstars and people who have great bodies and all this thing. People who are able to exemplify excellence, they're revered and rewarded in this, you know, in this world. And so I teach my children that, hey, listen, if you want to stand out and you want to have anything of note, then you have to be consistent at what you're doing. If you are consistent in your efforts at something, you will become an expert. You will become excellent at it. And then the world will be in awe of you. And, you know, they'll just marvel at your ability to do whatever it is that you're doing. The next thing that I teach my children, I teach them integrity, teach them the importance. So it's kind of gross, right? But we got it's a small group tonight, so I'll just share how I tell them. I'm like, you know, so integrity is, you know, doing the right thing when nobody is looking. And so I'll say, well, let me ask you this. If no one was looking, would you eat a booger? Right? And so it'd be like, oh, no. I'm like, that's essentially what integrity is. Like, yeah, you know, if you're like, I'm a booger eater, but I'm going to wait for people not looking. Or if you're a booger eater, then just eat boogers in front of everybody. That's having integrity. Like, I'm a booger eater and I'm proud. But, you know, I got a 10 and 11-year-old, so I got to kind of make this stuff fun. Then I teach them the importance of self-discipline. So, what one of the things is, so we wake up, you know, early in the morning before they go to school, and we do what's called a 20-mile march. It's like a little workout routine, nothing really strenuous, but I'm just trying to ingrain the behavior of getting up and being active and doing something every day. And what I do is we rotate whose responsibility it is to wake everybody. So we come downstairs, we're tired, you know, we're still sleepy or whatever. And it's whoever's day it is, they have to get everybody off the couch and get them moving and get them marching. So that way we shift, you know, that enforces self-discipline, because if it's your day, then you have to be the one up and at them and getting everybody to go. And then the other thing that I'm trying to get them to really embrace is the importance of planning, and that's mapping out what you're going to do. So it's planning your work and then working your plan. I struggle a little bit with that because, you know, I kind of sort of don't live like that. You know, I basically do what I want to do when I want to do it. But, you know, when I'm trying to achieve a goal, I do plan my work and I do work my plan, but I try to work my plan as fast as possible. And that's only because for my brain, if I don't have constant stimulation or whatever it is, I get bored fast. But, you know, I'm trying to have my kids not be like me. You know, I'm trying to have them be a little bit more focused, a little bit more disciplined. They don't have some of the external factors or some of the external pressures that I had growing up. So these are things that I feel will create well-rounded children. So every now and then you'll hear me talk about like our community resource centers. You'll hear me talk about the things that we want to do. My kids are the great experiment. My kids are the ones that I am figuring all of this stuff out. A lot of the other solutions that I'm proposing, so like the community resource center itself and providing the training for these children and things, that's a reflection from stuff from my own life. So like when I was coming up, right, we only had like a few options. I walk out my front door, you were either going to be handed a gun to go rob somebody, you were going to be handed some drugs to go sell something, or you're going to be handed a basketball, like to go shoot hoops or whatever. It just so happens that this guy was coming by selling balloons, you know, like the balloons back in the days, you blow them up with your mouth and you put the big red rubber band on them. It just so happens this guy was coming by. He was selling that. He was selling those. I wound up helping him, and he showed me another way. He showed me, you know, about selling. He showed me about business at an early age, and that interests me more than some of the other stuff. But for the vast majority of the other brothers, my cousins and the homeboys and all that stuff, like, we had nothing else. There was like no other outlet, right? So you're just going to sit there and you're going to get in trouble. And it's like the sister was saying, you know, this business right here, it's giving them something to do outside of, you know, outside of getting in trouble. Maybe that will be like the balloon guy. Maybe this little business could be like the balloon guy for me, because that just sparked my creative, you know, my creative thinking. And like, how many other things can I sell? So back then they didn't have bottled water, but I sold sodas on the boardwalk. I sold ice cream. I sold handballs, the little blue balls. I used to sell handballs. I used to sell all kinds of stuff, anything that I can get my hands on, right? So that created that entrepreneurial spark in me at a young age. And we can definitely take some of these children. I mean, of course, things need to be a little bit more structured for them, right? Because I didn't really learn about, like, the inventory, the management part of it, like, in a formal way. I just was thinking about, like, all right, I know I had this amount of money when I started. I mean, yeah, I know I had this much money when I started. I know I need this much to go buy some more, and then this is what I'm left with. So those are just some of the things that I want to share, and I feel that if we go and we start being serious about teaching our kids this and creating this type of change within our community, we can close that black wealth gap. It may not happen in our generation. It may not happen in our kids' generation. But as long as we start on that path, then eventually, you know, each year we can go on, it can get smaller and smaller, especially now since the country, the politicians and the business people, they're gutting this white middle class. They are killing their own people. And I say this all the time, when they are distracted and confused and fighting with one another, this is the best time for us to get our act together. Excuse me. This is the best time for us to get our act together. Some of the other businesses that we were talking about before, like starting the lawn cleaning service, I'm starting the lawn landscaping company, starting the junk removal and the hauling and all of that. Those types of businesses are very, very important because they don't take a lot of know-how. They don't take a lot of skill, but they make money. And those are the types of things that can create change. Those things can create the entrepreneurial spark that our brothers and sisters need. I'm telling you, I watched it happen over and over. For a perfect example, so like some of my properties, so I had some young black guys. I'm trying to build a crew out of some young guys, and then when I didn't have work for the guy, this dude he got into doing cleanouts, he got into hauling junk and stuff like that. And then next time when I went back to go hire him, yo, I don't know, man, I might have to schedule you next week. I'm kind of tied up. I'm like, what's going on? Oh man, I got a lot of work right now. Matter of fact, I need more guys on my crew. I'm like, wow. So this is something that that's definitely beneficial. So I'm gonna open the floor up if anybody has anything they want to chime in with. If not, then we can end this call early. Like I said, we don't have I'm sorry for that technical glitch. So we lost a few people during that little snafu. But, we can end this call early if no one has anything that they want to weigh in on. All right, brothers and sisters. Well, I want to thank everyone for coming to hang out with us, and we are going to shut this one down early. All right. So like I said, the next week we're going to have the raffle for the business in a box. So if you have not yet got a raffle, then we would appreciate your support, and I will see you all next week.
Hi, Deb. Good night. Good night.